Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
I got very good at editing. Well, what you do, the trick, I can tell you. Everybody remembers the intro of a song. And they remember the first verse. The chorus, usually the first chorus and the second chorus are the same, more or less. The second verse, so you could chop from the beginning of the first chorus to the beginning of the second chorus. And right there, that's a minute. So suddenly your song's 2.5 minutes long.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Nick, let's. Where do we go next? Where can we go next with, you know, this crazy London scene? Where do we go next?
Well, I can tell you about the birthday party was very funny because there was no budget, very little budget. It was on 4AD, and they were completely unknown. No one had ever heard of them any at all in England. So
except me,
except you, yeah. Except you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We were all Oslo in the Rock Garden.
Yes, we knew. You too.
And the scientists. I remember the scientists coming around as well.
Yeah, I remember the scientists.
Remember the scientists?
Yeah.
He's still around, is he? What's his name? Fish. Kim Salmon.
That's right. Yeah, he is around. Probably in Melbourne, I imagine.
All with the same Terrilyn shirts and stay pressed trousers. That was the look. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Melbourne, they're stylish, you know, Italians.
Italians and Greeks.
Course, yeah.
So, Mr. Cave and the birthday party, what happened there?
This townhouse was quite an expensive studio. You know, it was, you know, Queen.
Yeah, we remember tiptoeing in going, who's paying for this? Who's paying for this? Yeah, you are.
Yeah, it's just crazy. But you know, so the only way... I really wanted to do it at the townhouse because that's the only studio I knew how to work. So I said, oh, well, maybe if we come in at midnight, this was to Ivo, who, you know, Ivo of 4AD.
Ivo Watts Russell.
And he said, actually, that would really suit the band. Now, I'd never met them, right? They were coming over from Australia, or arrived from Australia. I had no idea what they looked like. All I knew was I had this cassette recording of Release the Bats Live, which was just this cacophony. And I loved it. I loved it. And so I said, we'd do it. So the idea was, yeah, they're going to turn up at midnight. And so I was setting up mics and doing all this. And I get a call from reception. And the receptionist's name was Penny. And she said, hey, Nick, can you come up to reception? Because I think it's one of your bands. They've arrived and they're scaring people. And I went up there and they were all in suits and they just looked like vampires. They really looked like vampires. And then, you know, doing
vampires
this song.
And Undertakers.
Yeah, Undertakers, yes. Yeah. And it was, the Robert Smith hair.
Yeah.
All of them. And very, very pale looking. And God knows what drugs they were on. And they just had that Australian sense of humour, that constant taking the piss, sarcasm thing. And I think, again, because of not growing up in England, either it didn't get to me because I didn't understand it as that.
Right.
I just thought they were great. I thought they were really fun. Oh, my dad was very witty. My dad was really witty. So Nick Cave and Mick Harvey and Roland's wit, it just felt familiar to me.
Because Nick comes from a very literary background as well, right? There's a lot of books in his growing up as well.
Yeah. So it was, you know, we started at midnight, you know, doing the song Release the Bat, starting at midnight, and they looked like vampires. It was just, it all made sense, and it just happened.
And the sun came up, you pulled the curtains back, and the smoke came.
Well, I think they left before the sun came up. I think they would have melted.
Every time wandering out into the daylight of Camden Town.
Yes. Oh, my God. 7 a.m. and everybody's driving to work and all looking fresh and scrubbed. Yeah. And all you're thinking is, I want to go to home and go to sleep.
Home and switch off. Yeah. Yeah, no chance. The makers of Gillette Blades were very pleased to know that Nick is still using some splicing skills.
A lot.
I saw you slicing a 24 track.
I mean, that's the thing that I learned first when I was at Tape One. I was doing lots of edits. And in fact, one of my job as a 18-year-old was... You remember those K-Tel records?
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, they would have 20 songs on them. They had to fit 10 songs on each side.
Oh, Jesus.
Which, of course, is impossible. You can't have 20 songs on an
album.
Thank
goodness you didn't.
So it was my job as an 18-year-old to rearrange hit records.
To slice them up.
Fit them in. So what I got very good at editing. And I also, I guess, learned about song structure,
right?
Because
these songs were hits, you know, and so
this knowledge is out in the public domain. I take it, you know, we're not going to be revealing something with it. There's the bastard that shot my single up.
Oh yeah, no, it's,
make the middle eight a middle four. Take out the guitar solo.
Well, what you do, the trick, I can tell you. Everybody remembers the intro of a song,
right?
And they remember the first verse.
Yes.
The chorus, usually the first chorus and the second chorus are the same, more or less.
Yeah.
The second verse, so you could chop from the beginning of the first chorus to the beginning of the second chorus, and right there, that's a minute.
Right.
So suddenly your song's 2.5 minutes long, so then you can fit, you know, 20.
Who do we have? Who do we have to you know, to thank for all of this, you know? Is it the excesses of Yes?
K-Tel,
yeah.
Yes, I know. I mean, Wire would never had this problem until their third album, you know. I mean, the Pink Flag was like 20-odd songs.
That's one of the best records ever.
But, you know, you could be a very gullible listener, because I bought Lamb, right, when I was a teenager, and I took it home and I played it, and it had a scratch on the record somewhere. So this one track, which was about down in New York City or something, it jumped, but it jumped at the right point every time. So I thought, I'd never heard the track. And for about 2 months, I thought, that's the way that track goes. The lyrics don't match up on the thing, but it jumps to the next one. Wow, that's really good. And it wasn't until I heard the proper version of it, I realized, oh, so it's really good.
That's called a miracle. That's what that is. Yeah. That's a miracle.
Yeah. My copy of Rolling Stone's Sticky Fingers didn't have a miracle on it. It just jumped at the wrong point. And I thought, like, whatever it was called, Bitch or something, that song, that just, like, well, that's weird. Charlie Watts is a weird drummer. Yeah. He just kind of keeps jumping beats around.
Yeah. But yeah, my copy of Lamb was like the first sort of scratching record, because it actually worked in time and it was in, you know, it was in with the beat, but it was wrong.
People would think that's all it was fit for. Like, yeah,
that's right.
Scratching. I like the way Motown always kind of jumped in on the chorus, you know. 2, 3, 4, stop, and then, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Get the chorus in, and then play it again, do two.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, that whole thing, about, you know, song arrangements. And, you know, obviously there is a general format, isn't there, still, you sure. know, of verse, chorus, middle, chorus out, or whatever. But I don't know. Anyway, all that editing, I just did a lot of editing before I recorded, ever recorded anything with microphones. I'd done a lot of editing. So to edit a multi-track, I wasn't scared at all. To me, it was like, and I was editing, I would sometimes edit, I guess, laterally, horizontally.
So like individual tracks and stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Because it's 2-inch, all you do is you get a ruler, you know, one of those metal rulers that's 1-inch.
Yeah.
And you just put that on top. So you match up your kick drum point where you're editing. But if you want the drum fill before, and the drums were on, say, tracks 1 to 11, they were at the top. So instead of the edit just being a, it was like a sort of. So I did that.
Oh, wow. Oh, you've got to know where all your tracks. You got you want all the drums in one. Like you want them on the first like 8 tracks, don't you? You know,
I did do that. I always put the bass on 1 and 2 because I learned that track 1 sometimes the top end wasn't very good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But if it was a bass guitar, then there wasn't anything up there anyway. Kind of.
Yeah.
But kind of. Yeah. I mean, all that technical stuff. I learned all the technical stuff before I even started, which is probably why when the Flowers of Romance,
that helped you a lot, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, I kind of knew enough to.
Right. You're kind of have been at the peak of your game for a long time. You're at maybe you're at the peak of your game now with like the most experience.
I'm interested. I think I just love it. And I'm interested in what's going on, you know. And
we're similar ages. We've got a similar reference points, and as well as feeling cynical about everything, I feel current somehow. It feels the right time. I feel like I've got more to give in many ways.
You do,
now.
You do, 100%.
It's a good feeling.
I was probably more relaxed about it too.
Yeah.
I definitely feel. I don't feel a pressure to impress. Well, maybe to impress, but not. I don't feel a pressure to keep working. But I just am. I mean, I just worked with this band from New York. This all-girl band called Cum Girl 8. C-U-M Girl 8. 8 is infinity, the infinity sign. Right. And they're amazing. They're absolutely amazing. I mean, people are saying they're a bit like the Slits. They're very, yeah. it grooves, and they're crazy on stage. I mean, like really wild. I'm sure you'll hear them in the next few months.
You're going to have to send me a link, Nick.
I'll send you the 2 songs I did. Actually, I did 4 songs. I've done an EP, but we just finished 2, and they just got signed to 4AD.
Nice,
actually. Yes, it's full circle.
I heard just recently, probably for the first time, the John Peel sessions that the Slits did before I joined them. And they I didn't realize that they'd already started really, I'd put recorded versions of what went on cut before. And really good session. You know, the Peel sessions were always good. No, it was just that they wanted something quite different. And Palmolive wanted to do something different. It's just, but it's interesting going back and hearing the power, you know, the just the energy that was going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I find, like, you know, another record I did recently with Amyl and the Sniffers. Do you know them?
Love Amyl and the Sniffers. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're...
What's the lady's name? I forget. Sir?
Amy. Yeah. She's just who she is, you know. There's no, it's not made up. But she, her energy and her attitude and her whole spirit is exactly like 1978.
If it wasn't blonde hair and it, she wasn't Australian, it'd be Ariana. Ariap.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very similar thing. And yet she, you know, working with Emma, realized that she actually hadn't listened to that music from back there. She's not influenced particularly by that. I mean, she sounds
neat. Right.
There's a, you know, I guess because her voice is quite high and she's going, it reminded me of Polystyrene, you know. And
yeah.
But I don't think she ever heard Polystyrene. She probably only heard it when people started saying, oh, she sounds like Polystyrene. And then she probably went and listened and go, oh, I can see that.
I listened to a track today where I think the backing track was out. So it's just her in front of the studio mic, a cappella.
Yeah,
and the rhythm and the it's like singing rap with her own poetry approach. Yeah,
she is a rapper. And in fact, during the mixing of that record, I got this message because it was during COVID, so I was in LA mixing it at my house, and they were in Australia, and she kept on wanting certain things about the mix that she did explain that, but also was struggling to explain. And then she suddenly sent me this text. She said, I've had an epiphany. And so I called her and she says, I don't listen to rock and roll, eh? I don't listen to punk rock. I listen to hip hop. I'm a rapper. And I just thought, yes, you are. That's right. 100%. And it's like, once that happened, it became so much easier because I just basically put loads of low end on the kick drum. And made the low end all about the kick drum and not about the bass particularly. Like the bass was more like higher up.
Yeah.
Right.
Because she told me, she says, when she's singing or rapping, she's listening to mostly the kick drum. And that's what she's bouncing.
Right.
You know, even though when you hear that record, it kind of sounds a little bit, I guess, like, you know, AC/DC and all the Sex Pistols, right? It's a kind of rock record.
Yeah.
It's mixed like a hip hop record. It's like all the guitars are quite sort
got,
of...
Got different reference points.
They're not thin, but they're not like huge.
It's a strange thing, that turnaround, of certainly the bass part and four on the floor bass drums. I mean, on the Slits album, there's like a melodic high bass line with and there's also the lumbering low sort of heavy dub bass line. And then you get like New Order, where Hookie's doing like, you know, and Severin and the Banshees, where they're playing melody, top line melody almost, on a bass guitar that's got like the strings all cranked up and
yeah.
You know, things change, times they change, because I remember I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, a couple of years ago, right? And I was there, and Mickey D, the first bass player in The Cure, me and Mike were in a cab together, and we had a couple of days there, so we went to visit somebody for lunch, and we're going across, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge or something, and a taxi driver, you know, or Uber or whatever it was, you know, was a young guy, and he's playing all this hip-hop stuff and things on it, and he looks at us for a few minutes. He goes, you know, where are you going? Why are you here? You know, and eventually he gets it out of us and we tell him. And so then he dials in, like, The Cure onto his, you know, system, and he's listening to it. He listens to a couple of songs. And then he turns around to me and Michael, and he goes, that's guitars, right? Because he'd never heard that. He was like, that's guitars, right? That's guitars.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, you know, the world's different, you know?
Yeah.
Michael Dempsey was the king of the 12th fret.
Yes, yes.
Ding a ding 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 ding. Those Associates records.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, whoa.
Yes.
Yeah. He still plays that way.
I want you to go like your high point, the next place you found yourself, probably with Kate Bush.
Oh, Kate. Yes. Yeah. Well, that was amazing. I mean, that, you know. I've done quite a lot of interviews this year.
I know. I imagine you would have. Yeah.
Not many people that she worked with, because she's, you know, once she built her own studio,
yeah,
it's all in her cocooned world, which is, you know, understandably that she wanted to do that. But yeah, I got a call I was in Jamaica in the jungle. I got a call from the BBC saying, you know, is this Nick Launay? And you worked with Kate Bush. Can we interview you? And I said, yeah. And it was within 15 minutes of that. And I said, well, so when you edit this, and they go, oh, no, it's live. It was the craziest thing. But it was great because I just sort of remembered that album. And it really was like, I mean, I was 20, I suppose, maybe 21. And she was like 1 year older. So it really was two kids let loose, because she was producing it, you know, and I was engineering it.
Wow.
And that was it, you know. So, and obviously she's so imaginative. She'd come in with these really crazy ideas of a sonic landscape that she wanted.
Right.
And I just did it, you know, and I had no understanding of limits and rules.
No,
we just did it.
She sounds like she was working in a very visual way as well, giving you visual clues.
Very visual, yeah.
We didn't have that restriction. We didn't have... It's funny when I do see a lot of YouTube videos and postings of analysis of drum beats or structures of songs, and they all they seem to be concerned with is getting the beats in the right place. You know, dividing time, or we didn't have the facility or the technique available. We just had ideas, and we thought, how the shit do I get my drums to sound like a Zulu tribe, like all rattling spears.
Yeah. Lots of toms.
Yeah. We played for different things. I mean, you know, I never played, you know, against a click track or anything like that. I would play to Robert's voice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'd have him sing in the studio with me, and, you know, two or three of us would put something down and I'd play against his voice.
And that's why those records are so good.
Right.
You know, that is why those records are so good, because you are playing to the voice, you know.
And right,
like a lot of the Nick Cave records, well, all the Nick Cave records that I did, the Grinder Man and all that,
yeah,
it's all done, you know, the vocals on those records are mostly, like, if not all on some songs, the take that was done at the time, because everybody's playing to his vocal. There's absolutely no clicks. There hardly even any tuning up. It's not necessary, you know, it's not in tune, it's not in time, and that's what gives it that human element. But yeah, even the Kate Bush stuff wasn't done to a click, you know?
No,
not that I know. It absolutely wasn't.
Well, there wouldn't have been at that time. There wouldn't have been any sort of...
It was down to us, lol. It was down to me and you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
The timekeepers.
I played with Mickey D a little while back, and halfway through we were playing, he just stopped and he went, "That's why I play the bass that way, because of that kick drum." He said that the way you play the kick, he said, "That's why I play like this," and I'd forgotten, you know. And you forget, just like it's the joy of playing something together, and it's not all lined up on the grid or whatever, you know. It's like, it's still beautiful, you know.
Yeah. Well, this, you know, glad to say some bands are still doing it that way. Not many.
Yeah, not many. No, no, not many.
I mean, Amel and the Sniffers is no clicks. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
I can imagine that, yeah, because they sound pretty punk, yeah.
The other band I like from Oz is The Chats. I just looked them up.
Yeah.
Because I always remember the song, they go, "I'm having a smoke-o."
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't know what it meant. It was a smoke-o. A cigarette break, right? I'm having a smoke.
Yeah,
and it was so like...
Cigarette break, right.
Felt so like I was whisked back to 1976 somewhere, you know, an Eater.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember Eater. They were all about 3 years old, right?
It was like straight out of the factory.
They were very funny.
Like, right about what you're doing. What's the big plans, Nick?
Yeah.
What's going on next?
I got lucky, I suppose, or another thing happened where I ended up doing the score for Peaky Blinders.
That's amazing, with Anna Calvi.
The last season, yeah. So Anna did season 5 on her own. And then season 6, the director wanted to make it, you know, Season 5 is very much her and her guitar. It's quite simple in a brilliant way. I mean, it's fantastic.
Right.
And but this one, he wanted more.
Yes.
And so she asked me to help her with it. And then because of COVID, a lot of things happened during COVID. And one of the things is she had a baby. So she couldn't do it. She couldn't finish it.
Right.
So, or at least couldn't for a while.
Yeah.
And so I took over and ended up composing a lot. With odd sounds and, you know, very David Lynch style. If you listen to season 6, you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I ended up, you know, diving into that world, like in the deep end. It was just me and the director during COVID. You know, him in England, me in LA.
Yeah.
And then I did some of it here in Sydney, some of it in Spain. I mean, it took 5 months to do all the music to that. And so now I'm being asked to do other films and TV, so I'm getting into that now.
Peaky Blinders, that's run its series, its course.
Yes, I think so. I mean, they're going to make a movie.
Yeah.
A movie. I don't know who's directing it, or I mean, I don't think it's a different director. So I don't have. I mean, God knows, I might get a phone call. I would love to, but it's those kind of things. It's a very different world.
Yeah,
there's so many people involved, and it's and so many companies. I mean, that Peaky Blinders is the BBC and Endemol Shine, and which is they do all those big reality shows, and so it's a whole different thing. It's very difficult to get into that world.
Yeah,
actually, yeah. And again, I was just because I basically was helping Anna out to yeah, make it work. Yeah. And Toby Dammit.
Larry, yes.
Larry, he's the drummer on it. And John Baggett, do you know, from Portishead, he plays on it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because Toby was here last day because he was somewhere between here and Oslo, I think. Or somewhere like that. Anyway, but he was playing Berlin Babylon. Yeah, there's a big series here in Germany, in Berlin. And he was like the 1940s, 1930s, 40s big band drummer.
Yeah.
And he was kind of like based around... So the opening titles were based around his little drum solo,
right,
which is kind of pretty amazing. Because he has the kit from that period still, you know.
Wow.
The old Slinger lens and stuff.
Wow.
And Anna's like just... We were talking to Anna as we were doing our album as well, and... Looking for
Anna's great.
Yeah,
love Anna.
I crossed paths with her a lot in 2000, just before lockdown. I was on tour with John Grant, and we hit the same festivals. And I was just spellbound, you know. Stood at the mixing desk with Head, my old friend from back in the day.
Yeah,
just going, wow. And I remember this one gig where she'd bust like the main string, which had thrown the whole guitar out for this long intro of the big closing song from Hunter, I think.
Right.
And and she had to kind of keep it going and hold everything while the one tech changed the one guitar. Apparently came off and was furious because they were nowhere to be seen. You know, it was the most amazing thing. I knew what was going on, and she pulled it off. And I went back to sort of say, that was amazing. And all I found was a destroyed dressing room.
Uh-oh.
You know, up the stairs. And I knew... what had happened. I could see like shoes everywhere and bottles. It was like trashed. And then I heard voices, screaming voices coming down the stairwell. And I'd never met. So I just went like, well, that was fucking amazing. You were amazing. And they went, really? Where have you come from? Like, maybe some other gig. And it's just like one of those moments where you get the chance to give somebody something that...
She probably needed that, right?
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. No, you are my secret weapon, our secret weapon. You know, you make everybody smile, Budgie.
Yeah,
in a good way.
So, and I think when you're up on stage, obviously, it's a very different experience to being in the audience.
Sure.
I mean, very often I go backstage all the time. You know, see bands I've worked with, and then they're very often the best gigs. They're all kind of very hum ho about it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sometimes it might sound really good on stage and doesn't sound so good.
We know.
But Anna is amazing in that she's so quiet,
yeah,
and so shy actually,
yeah,
in person. And then she's up on stage and she roars, you know.
playing with The Cure, I could guarantee, you know, if we played and we had a great gig and, you know, I could think, oh yeah, that was a really great gig, I could guarantee Robert thought it was terrible, right? And then we would come off sometimes and I'd think, oh, that was shit, wasn't it? He was going, that was the greatest gig we've ever done, you know? So people's perspective changes, you know?
I think this is the DD, this is the drummer's dilemma, lol, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
We could well be in a different band most nights, you know?
Don't you often have different things in your you know, fold back?
Yeah, you don't have anything in there. That's why it sounds great.
Yeah.
You just have yourself. I sound great. I know it was a great.
I couldn't hear myself. Neither could I.
About 2011, I came down to Australia because I persuaded Robert, let's go out and play the old albums. And he said, yeah, okay. So we went down and we were going to play them in the Opera House, you know. And it's the first time that I had actually used in-ears, because I hadn't been on the road for a long time, you know, and I hadn't used in-ears. So I went and got some in-ears. And just before we're going on stage for the second night, I turned to Simon and I said, Simon, I heard all of your bass last night, everything that you were playing. And he turned around to me and he went, I'm sorry. I said, no, it was really good. It was really good. It was great. I could actually play, you know, with you, as opposed to not hear what you're doing, you know, just watching what you're doing, you know. So
my story like that would be from Gnomus Studios in West London.
I remember that place.
And we used to share a crew with Motorhead. So when Motorhead were recording, we'd go out with the rig and the lights and the sound system and vice versa. But there were occasions when we'd both been in the same rehearsal complex and we'd both been acquired these radio packs for the instruments. So, but we found ourselves, Lemmy was on the same frequency and the noise that was coming into our room from his rig, and it was just twang. It was I know why me and Filthy Animal, Phil Taylor, we used to bond. I think we were like these two, you know, this blonde-haired skinny bloke and this big kind of sort of looks like a Mexican gunslinger, but both with dance tights on. We both had like ballet tights because that's all. Otherwise, we were too wet.
I remember seeing him play, like Motorhead play, the Reading Festival 1979, and we were like on the festival bill, you know, and we were like, you know, petrified of everything, you know, and we got there and I went out and watched Motorhead play and I was in total awe that he could play like double kick drums with those boots, like those huge leather boots that came all the way up to his knees. I was like, how the hell can he do that? You know, it's just like, it was impossible. So
legend.
He was great. But they were lovely to us, actually. Motorhead were the nicest people to us as a band, a young band. They were lovely.
Their crew was legendary as well.
Yeah.
They tried to destroy us, just tried to, you know, it was just, yeah. But we survived somehow. I'm so glad we survived. I'm so glad we've had this conversation.
It's amazing we're alive.
It is, really, when we think about it. It's pretty
amazing. Well, I guess I was slightly more sheltered inside. I was kept inside all these years.
So it's hats off to Lemmy and Phil Collins, and the cast is endless, right?
Yes.
Nick, you've had a charmed life so far.
That's great.
So far, so good. Yeah, I'm not done yet. Actually, I'll tell you, the thing I'm most excited about that's coming out is actually a song, an Iggy Pop song I did with Anna. It's an Anna Calvi.
Oh, good.
While we're mixing the Hunter album, you know, obviously I'm very busy, you know, busy, and she's in the back of the studio, you know, writing lyrics and stuff. And then she said, do you know Iggy Pop? And I said, well, I know him, like, not that close with him, but I, you know, every time he comes here, I go backstage and say hi.
Yeah.
But anyway, she told me this story that she played Glastonbury, I think it was, and she looked to the side of the stage while she was playing. Iggy was there, and he stayed for the whole of her set, and he's just, you know, holding on to something, you know that how he does.
Yeah.
And then when she walked off stage, she had to walk past him, and she was really very starstruck and a bit nervous about walking past him, and he said, you know, he said, "Hey, I really like your music." And she's like, "Oh, I really like your music." And then he said, "Yeah, like maybe we should do something, you know?" And so she, out of nervousness, said, "A song? We should do a song?" And he said, like, "Yeah, but I, you know, I need help with writing songs. I don't write my own songs. I always write with people." Okay. So she said, "Oh, I'll write you a song." And he said, "That'd be great." And off he went, you know, to do his warm-up that he does before, because he was on next, you know. And she said, "Well, I've just finished the song." And I said, "So you've written a song?" I said, "Well, when did this happen?" She said, "This was like 2 years ago." So anyway, we demoed it, well, recorded it, sent it to him. Yeah. He loved it, and he ended up singing on it. So there is a song that is going to come out in the next probably 6 months from now.
Wow.
And it's so good. It is one of the best things I've ever been involved in. It's Iggy Pop doing right. what you want Iggy Pop to be doing. And the song is such a good song. I mean, Anna's just such a great songwriter. And she sings on it too. You know, it's not a duet, but they sing together.
Yeah.
And it's very glam. It's glam. It's a good beat.
You heard it here first. We got the lowdown.
Yes.
I want to hear it here first. So.
So I'm very... That's probably the next thing that's going to come out that's in the pipeline
okay.
to be released. We actually finished it quite a long time ago, but then COVID happened and, you know, well, COVID happened, didn't it? That's what happened. COVID happened.
I know. Well, yeah. Nick, it's been lovely meeting you for the 10th time, but for the first time properly.
Yes, exactly. It's been lovely.
It's been great chatting with you both. I'm glad we did this from the three corners of the planet Earth.
We're pretty international, me and Mr. B.
Happy New Year. See you in 23. Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.